Hello, my name is Moshe Mittelman from Tel Aviv, and I am very glad to open this session today. This is the episode number 4 of the MDS Foundation Professional Report. Today here with us is Dr. Howard Oster from Tel Aviv. Dr. Oster is the chairman of medicine, internal medicine A, in the Tel Aviv Soraski Medical Center, and a well-known international expert on MDS as well. Hello, Howie.
Hi, how are you, Moshe?
Okay, glad that you are here with us. And together we will discuss several recent publications that came out really in the last few weeks or months, which we believe will be within the interest of our listeners. So with no further introductions, I would like to go to the first presentation, which is entitled Phase 2 Study of Azacitidine with Pembrolizumab in Patients with Intermediate 1 or Higher Risk Myelodysplastic Syndromes. This is a paper that came out a few months ago in the British Journal of Hematology, written by a group. The first author is Kelly Shane. I hope I read correct her name, and the team is led by Dr. Hagop Kantarjan and Dr. Guillermo Garcia Manero. Now, Dr. Oster, can you please tell us what is the background of such a study? Why is it so important?
So we know that there are patients who are treated with for high-risk MDS, and they're treated with hypomethylating agents. Azacitidine, decitabine, these are given as first-line therapy. The response rate is about 50% and lasts up to 2 years. And, of course, we're always looking for improvements. Now, over the last decade, we've learned about immune checkpoint inhibitors, pembrolizumab, nilovimab. These have been successfully introduced into treatment of solid tumors and hematologic neoplasms like Hodgkin's disease.
But correct me if I'm wrong, these agents have not been shown to be successful in MDS. So why would it be reasonable to combine these two agents?
So the programmed cell death protein, PD-1 and the PD-1 ligand 1, it turns out that their expression is upregulated in CD34 bone marrow cells from patients with MDS. So it's possible to hypothesize that these might actually improve the treatment over hypomethylating agents to improve results.
So based on these two assumptions, number one, that we have to improve the relatively low percentage, about 50% response rate to hypomethylating agent, and the second one, that PD-1 and PD-L1 are highly expressed in MDS patients, this was, I understand, the basis for this study. So what did they do?
Right. So what they did is they looked at two cohorts. They looked at one cohort of 17 previously untreated patients, and they treated them. Again, this was a phase 2 trial, and they saw that the overall response rate was actually 76%.
Pretty high.
Yeah, that's very nice, with a complete response rate of about 18%. The median overall survival after a median follow-up of about 13 months. The second group was patients who had failed hypomethylating agents. There were 20 patients in this group, and the overall response rate in this group was 25% with a complete response of 5%. There was a median follow-up of about 6 months, and the overall survival was about 5.8 months.
So this leads us to probably one or couple of questions. Question number one, it is a good opportunity to say something about the patients who fail on first-line hypomethylating agent.
So usually their prognosis is quite poor. And so it's actually to find a group that has an overall response rate of 25% is actually a little bit of a point of light for these patients.
So this group is still very sad group. Right. Now let's go back to the first cohort. What do you think about the response rate as well as the duration of response?
So it's actually very nice compared to what we were seeing. Now, of course, this is a combination therapy with hypomethylating agents, and there are other agents that have been tried as well, pevonedistat, venetoclax, that have been shown to show approximately similar response rates. So it's going to be interesting to see in this patient cohort as there are larger numbers of patients. I imagine they're going to go on for a phase 3 trial, to see if how that compares with other combination therapies.
So this brings me sort of to the summary. What's your take home message that you have or you take, and how would you say today, let's say in August, September 2021, if I have a patient with higher risk MDS and I know that I'm going to give him Vidaza or decitabine, but probably I would like to add anything. Of all the possibilities that we have, and you mentioned some of them, venetoclax, pevonedistat, rigosertib, and now also checkpoint inhibitors, what I'm going to do, is it enough what you see here to say, hey, we are going to this combination or the other one?
I'm not sure that it's enough for me to actually make that decision for treating my patients today, but it's certainly enough for me to suggest for them to be part of a phase 3 trial and to watch the literature very, very carefully to see what actually happens with this combination therapy.
So can you summarize in one or couple of sentences what's the main message of this paper, please?
So the main message of this paper is that that there is the possibility of, because of the PD-1 and the PD-L1 expression in the cells of these patients, it makes sense biologically, and it looks like we have a possibility for a combination therapy, including hypomethylating agents and these checkpoint inhibitors. It's actually very exciting for the future.
Thank you, Dr. Oster.
Thank you.
We can go to the second paper. And now let's move on to the next presentation, which is entitled Personalized Prediction Model to Risk Stratify Patients with Myelodysplastic Syndromes. This is a paper that came out actually this month in the last issue of the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And the first author is Aziz Naza on behalf of an international group. And I saw that this is really kind of unusual paper. Now, Dr. Oster, can you tell us briefly why is it unusual and what are the specific and the unusual tools that used in this particular research?
Okay, so first of all, models to predict, risk stratify, this is something that's very close to my heart. And I will add that the fact that the group is from Cleveland, my hometown, that's also very exciting for me. But back to the science here, we know there's a great variability and heterogeneity of patients with MDS. Now, we have methods to classify them, to classify their status, to their stage, their prognosis.
You are talking mainly about prognostic classifications.
Exactly.
In other words, patients who are just diagnosed are classified in order to predict their prognosis.
Exactly. Now, there are limitations in this. I think that any clinician who deals with such patients will be able to relate to the frustration sometimes that we have a patient, for example, who is classified as low-risk MDS, yet we see him clinically that he suffers from an aggressive course of disease. So what these authors set out to do is to see if they can improve the models, the prognostic models, and see what strategies can be used, what other data can be included to make a more accurate prediction of survival.
And what strategy did they take, and why is it different from previous models or previous classifications? We know now the FAB old one, which is still useful for many of us still,
sure.
50 years after. We are all familiar with the IPSS, International Prognostic Scoring System, with the IPSSR, with the WHO classification, even the recent one is from 2016. And so what new tools and what is different in this new effort, this new strategy compared with previous?
Well, they incorporated advanced analytic tools and included clinical data, pathologic data, molecular data. They looked at almost 1,500 patients, 1,471 MDS patients, and took all of this information and made a training cohort using machine learning techniques. Now, just I'll open a parenthesis with machine learning techniques. One of the exciting things about it is sometimes you will find variables that you didn't necessarily think were important for your model, for prognosis, for example, and it turns out that they are important. So they created this algorithm. They then did a validation with more patients other patients that were not included in this in their originally training cohort. And what they found was that the number one that the median age of the training cohort was 71 years old, with commonly mutated genes, including SF3B1, TET2, ASXL1. In other words...
Which is already well-known information.
Exactly. In other words, their cohort is a cohort that we can identify with. These are very similar to many of the patients that we're dealing with all the time. And their algorithm identified a number of parameters as being important for prognosis, especially the chromosomal karyotype, platelet levels, hemoglobin levels, blast percentages in the bone marrow, age, but then also a number of other clinical variables, certain specific gene mutations, I think there were 7 of them, and the number of mutations that each patient had.
So can you summarize the main message of this paper, and how do you see the field moving on?
So the conclusion of the paper was that such a prediction model that was based on both clinical, many, many aspects of the data, including genomic data, even outperformed the established prognostic models in MDS. One of the most interesting things about it was that it was a dynamic model, so that it predicted survival and leukemia transformation probabilities at different time points, which is something that we don't always have with our other prediction models, and would allow for changing of the staging of the patient for a better staging or a worse staging, depending on how things transpired with time. So I think this is actually a very promising strategy, which can extend our knowledge and improve the accuracy of submodels. And because it's associated with personal information for each patient and the fact that it's dynamic, then this can really lead to true personalized medicine that changes from the time of diagnosis through time through the patient's disease.
So you think that this kind of strategy may be extended and may come probably the rule of thumb and the strategy that we will all use in future classifications?
I think that will definitely be part of that, yes.
Thank you, Howie. Thank you.
Now let's move on to the third paper that we wanted to discuss today. The title is Therapy-Related Myelodysplastic Syndromes Deserves Specific Diagnostic Subclassification and Risk Stratification, an Approach to Classification of Patients with TMDS. Moshe, can you tell me what is TMDS and tell me what's important about that?
Yeah, I have to say that I was very happy to read this paper because for several years we have been thinking that probably the entity called therapy-related MDS or TMDS or secondary MDS is somewhat neglected. And I will mention again to our listeners that basically we mean those patients who have probably one malignancy, such as Hodgkin's or breast or whatever, are treated, cured, and several years later, they are diagnosed as having MDS, which is usually secondary MDS or therapy-related MDS. And usually we are used to say that these patients have poor prognosis, and that's all. Unfortunately, most of these patients are excluded from most of clinical trials, and the information that we have about them is basically little one.
So how have we considered these patients before? Where did we place them? What kind of categories do we place them in?
So I'm not sure that we even used to categorize them because we used to think that these are patients with poor prognosis and to treat them as high-risk MDS. I'm not sure that we were right to do it, but probably it's important to know that the recent WHO classification from 2016 categorized them together with T-related or therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia and therapy-related myeloproliferative neoplasms, and this was one group together. And one of the issues, one of the points that this team wanted to investigate was, is it the right thing to group these three entities, TMDS, TAML, and TMPN, together?
So what did they do?
So basically, this is an international team led by Andrea Quingen and Detlef Hasse from Germany. But as I said, this is an effort of international team. And basically, they took data from very large number of patients. They were able from the international cohorts to collect data on more than 2,000 patients with therapy-related MDS. I believe that this is definitely one of the largest, if not the largest, series of these patients. And they went over the parameters that served for the WHO classification and compared these parameters and these patients to the other two patient groups, to the TAML and to the TMPN, as well as to about a cohort, a huge cohort of more than 4,000 patients with primary MDS.
Okay. And what did they find?
The findings were quite of interesting, although not that surprising, I would say, because many of us have felt the same for years. So the conclusions were that these patients with therapy-related MDS do not behave like therapy-related AML and therapy-related MDS-MPN, which means that probably they should be regarded as a separate subgroup, hopefully in the next classification. The other interesting and important conclusion was that these patients are basically similar, although in more aggressive course than the primary MDS.
So how are they similar and how are they different?
So in a way you could say that you can use the same parameters serving for the WHO classification. However, if you take, for example, excess blast 1, EB1, what we formerly called RAEB, R-A-E-B-1, with increased number of blasts but less than 10%. If you take two patients, one of them with primary MDS and the other one with therapy-related MDS, you can expect the therapy-related MDS with EB1 to have poor prognosis. But the important point is that you can still use the same WHO classification. So in other words, yes, this is a separate group. Don't include it in the TAML and TMPN MDS, but you can still use the WHO classification, and hopefully these patients now can be included in future clinical trials.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So the last paper that we're going to discuss today is titled Influence of Platelet Count at Diagnosis and During the Course of Disease on Prognosis in MDS Patients. This is from the Annals of Hematology, online at this point. It's from the German group. The first author is Judith Strapatsas. I hope I pronounced that correctly. The group of Ulrich Germin. Moshe, tell me about the background of this. What led them to make this study?
Yeah, I think there are two or three interesting points that we should probably mention. The first one, it's not, fortuitous that it's coming from Düsseldorf, because in Düsseldorf they have probably the oldest registry of MDS patients, started, I believe, maybe in the 90s of the previous century by Carlo Ohl, and this is continues under the leadership of Ulrich Germin. And obviously such a large series and registry can allow them and can provide them data that can be studied. So this was indeed a retrospective study, but the registry allows such study. This is one point. Second point which I would like to emphasize is the role of platelet count. Now, unfortunately, the platelet series has not gained attention in MDS and many in other diseases, such as the erythroid lineage and erythroid cells and red blood cells and so on, but there is some information. And from the information that we know today in 2021, we can say, number one, that indeed low platelet count is considered poor prognostic feature in MDS. This is both because, number one, it predisposes for bleeding, and number two, it probably indicates the bone marrow function and bone marrow failure. So it's kind of really an important and reliable prognostic factor. So these are the two main points that we should emphasize before getting into the real paper that was recently published in Annals of Hematology.
So this is information that's already known.
Yes, correct.
So now what can you tell me about what they set out to do in this paper with their retrospective study of their registry?
So this group from Düsseldorf decided to study the role of platelet count at presentation, and can they confirm the importance of platelet count, or I should say low platelet count, in a prognosis of MDS. The second point, they wanted to correlate it with bleeding, an issue that has been there is a very paucity of information about the bleeding complications in such patients. And the third one, which is probably not the first one, but still very important, is to find out whether there is a dynamics to the platelet count. What does it mean that the platelet count drops? Does it make a difference to the patients? So this was the study.
Okay. So how many patients did they include? What did they look at?
So they took from the registry data on 334 patients, all MDS patients from the Düsseldorf registry. And as we said, this is a retrospective study. And there are some interesting and important data, even if not to say this is the first report, but this is important. For example, number one, they indeed confirmed that low platelet count at presentation is associated with poor prognosis, with the forms of higher risk MDS, and actually also with some kind of hypocellularity of the megakaryocytes in the bone marrow. This was the first conclusion or the first main result. The second one was focusing on the bleeding. And they got the results that about 14% of the patients have bleeding episodes at presentation, but the number rises to 48%. So almost out of every two patients with MDS during the course of the disease suffers from bleeding, which is a very large number. And I'm not sure that this is well known to all the MDS community.
What do you think the impact of that was in terms of the outcomes of these patients?
Well, they also tested this one and they came out to the conclusion that low platelet count is associated with bleeding, and bleeding came out in this study to be the third cause of bleeding. So we know that these patients eventually die of infections, which is the most common reason. We know that the second common reason is leukemic transformation, but here they point out that the third cause of death in these MDS patients are bleeding. Yes, obviously, bleeding of visceral organs and other serious episodes of bleeding. And probably another point which I would like to emphasize, it was indeed associated with poor survival. Patients with low platelet count had shorter survival, 21 versus 49%, as well as high AML transformation rate, 22% compared with 8.3%.
Wow. That's pretty significant. And this was in those patients who had the decrement of platelets over the first 6 months?
Right. In fact, they confirmed the previous study, and I can say that this is our European MDS group study, published 2 years ago in Advances of Hematology. The first leading author was Rafa Isaacson from Paris. And in this paper, we showed probably for the first time that a decline during the first 6 months of the platelet count probably indicates poor prognosis. And here, if in fact, this German group confirms it. So it's not only the low platelet count at presentation, but also the decline of platelets over time, which indicates poor prognosis.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. So this was the episode number 4 of the MDS Foundation Professional Report, and we are glad to conclude this episode. Listen to that, and please come again for episode number 5.